Graham Seal and Rob Willis here again with one more Yarns of Oz. This time we're going to look at the fluid relationship between fact and folklore in the tales of Ben Hall and other bushrangers of the Lachlan region. There's two streams of history. There's the written side and there's the oral side, or the factual and the folkloric, if you like. There's that which is referenced and the stories and tales that are passed down through communities and families, which sometimes differ from the written. So how do these tales change in personal and general transmission, and what are the consequences?
You've got a foot in both camps, I think, haven't you, Graham? I mean, from your academic training as a historian and also your love of folklore. So this could be very, very interesting.
That's right. I'm interested in the way they collide. And the reality and the fact and the folklore, yeah.
Do we draw conclusions, though? That's the question that I ask. We'll see what happens, eh?
Okay.
All right. I thought we might have a look at one of Australia's best known bushrangers, or I'm going to say he is anyway, who just happens to be buried in my hometown of Forbes, so he's not going to be shifting anywhere. And as someone who's resided in Forbes for the majority of their life, there are definitely two different streams here. There's people who tell these stories, and also those who he's not. There's a cringe here about Hall being an outlaw. It's quite amazing. I knew of Hall as a kid because we pedalled my bike up to the cemetery to have a look at the grave, but not much of an idea who he was. You know, it was just, oh yeah, he's a bushranger. That's pretty romantic. And no one seemed to want to talk about him. This is going back to the 1950s. Much later, when we started to record for the National Library, and I started to dig with the people, this is about 40 years ago, and there were people there who still had these memories. Of course, a lot of these, as you would appreciate, had been handed down. It's what, I suppose it's what we call folklore, isn't it?
Oh, indeed, yeah, and particularly in local areas where the bushrangers operated. You've still got very long memories, folk memories, if you like to call it. I think that probably explains why people didn't want to talk about it. It was because they generally turn out to be such traumatic incidents for the local community because they divide them one side and the other. The ones who support the bushrangers for one reason or another, who sympathise with them. And then, of course, there's a very large group on the other side who are kind of, generally speaking, their victims, who aren't terribly happy about it at all. And those things, particularly in local communities, can live on for a very, very long time.
Yeah, what I did notice that when we did start to record these stories, there were lots and lots of stories about grandmothers who were given lollies by the bushrangers and looked after and this sort of thing. And maybe we'll come back to that a little bit later because I'm fascinated with your Robin Hood theory, which we'll talk about. Let's start with a grab that John Meredith and I got from a fellow, Pat Nicholson, and this is typical of the stories that the people around Forbes would tell me.
Tell us about your dad being here. This is in Forbes.
In Forbes. This old uncle of his, he was a Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
He was on the veranda of one of the pubs here. He was great. He'd be on a pub veranda because he always liked rum. And he was there when the police brought Ben Hall in, when they shot Ben Hall.
Yeah.
They shot him not so very far out here. Mm. And they strapped him over a horse. And
this
tied
the body.
Yeah, when after he brought him in. And there's our dad's old uncle. He's a Jack Nicholson. He was there and saw them police ride past with Ben Hall strapped on the horse. And Ned Kelly's sister is buried here.
Kate.
Kate Foster.
Yeah.
She's buried up there, not far from Ben Hall. But you take now, well, the likes of Ben Hall, he wasn't such a terrible bloke. He didn't do the things that these fellas are doing today to women and young children, did he?
So that's the sort of thing that I was getting, Graham.
Yeah, it's very much in the vein of the outlaw hero, who doesn't do harm to women or children, doesn't use unnecessary violence, And sort of is seen to be a friend of the poor and the oppressed, often self-defined, but anyway. And you get this kind of ongoing memory, which that that clip really nicely displays, I think. But also, of course, you've got the songs and the stories, which we'll talk about as we go through, which also put the same kind of view that they're Bush Robin Hoods, if you like, just to put it in a nutshell.
Yeah. I think, as I said earlier, that the thing that created an awareness of Hall in particular for me was reading Frank Clune's Ben Hall, the Bushranger, and later the Wild Colonial Boys. I loved them, and I think it actually led me into an interest about them. Were there many more books or romantic episodes written before Clune?
Yeah, I think so. There's always been a very strong sort of journalistic and popular history writing tradition in Australia. It goes right back to the 19th century. And Clune was definitely in that tradition. It continues today with various authors who like to romance the stone, if you like. And certainly, you know, they find a good story and they make it an even better story. And I think that Frank Clune stuff very much falls into that kind of category. And Frank also, as I said, was a bit of a romancer, but he also, at the same time, he, I think, had a genuine interest in the history as well. So he was a man who had done quite a lot of research into it, but he'd also, he was at an era where there were still quite a few, enough people around with memories, direct memories, of having been involved with or lived in the area or whatever it might have been when the Kellys or the or Ben Hall or Frank Gardner, whoever it was, depredated.
Yeah, well, I know that he came through. He was a travelling accountant, and again, many years ago, I haven't recorded anyone talking about it, but he used to come through and travel all over central west New South Wales in the 1930s and do people's books, do their tax. So he would come into town and he'd go to the local, well, in this case, Greek cafe or the local pub, which he loved. And he was also a collector of folklore, because I think among his books from memory there's lots of poems and other things written as well.
Oh yes, definitely, yeah. It's like Bill Wannan's another one, Bill Beattie, he was very popular around about the same time. Going back a little bit earlier, you've got people like what's his name, Bill Bowyang, which was his pen name, Frank Reed. Again, these people made a living, generally speaking, by journalism, by their pens. So they often wrote for newspapers. And in those days, newspapers were syndicated. So if you wrote an article or published a poem that someone had sent in from the bush, which they did an awful lot in those days, they often got syndicated to the local newspapers right around the country. So that's where you start to pick up a lot of this stuff. And Frank was probably picking that up as well as the actual stories from the places that he visited.
Yeah, I think so. And one fella I came across was the late Edgar Penzig. Edgar saw both sides of the fence. I've done an interview with Edgar, which I think is online, actually, from the National Library. He started off reading Clune, and then he would go around and signpost all the bushranging sites and things like that. And later on, he discovered that, in his mind, that it wasn't all right, and Clune wasn't as straightforward, perhaps, as what he should have been. He found out the facts. I've got a bit of a grab here from Edgar, talking about both sides of the fence. And the second part of it is from someone we'll hear from a little bit later, or very, very shortly, actually, Maurie Stiles, who was all for Clune. So let's have a listen to both of their thoughts.
Well, when I was in my late teens, early 20s, I was doing motorcycle speedway racing, but always was interested in history, but knew nothing about our own country, because you couldn't see an Australian film then. There were no books. You would go into a shop and the Australian books, where now they'll be 30 foot long and 3 or 4 shelves. In those days, it'd be 20 inches. You just couldn't buy Australian books. But anyhow, I was doing speedway racing and an old ex-rider said, he heard me talking about Wyatt Earp. Of course, I'd bought some true books on the American Wild West, which is a very exciting period. And he heard me talking about Wyatt Earp and he said, you want to wake up to yourself, Edgar? I said, why, Fred? He said, "We had blokes here the Yanks couldn't hold a candle to." I said, "I've never heard of them." He said, "I'll lend you a book." And he lent me The Wild Colonial Boys. Now, because it said in the foreword, this is authentic history throughout, and if there are any mistakes, they were in the official papers we gleaned. I, as a young bloke of 22, didn't realise that people would tell whoppers. And for years I'd stand up at my lectures and say, after I'd spoken to service groups, historical groups, "Beg, borrow, steal or buy, Frank Clune's Wild Colonial Boys, it is the Bible of Australian bushranging." I could cut my tongue out now. Of course, we found out this man, Clune, never even wrote the book, and it was written by a man who'd been imprisoned in an internment camp as a Nazi during the Second World War, and it was 70% fiction. And I meant, the sad thing is, it read well, and not only me, Peter Smith the author, Kevin Passig, all my fellow authors who are now into true bushranging history, we were all sucked in by this book. The only thing I will give it, and Peter Smith and all agree the same, it launched us with an interest into Australian bushranging.
What are your sentiments against the Wild Colonial Boys? It's fairly close to the truth from what Dan Charters mentioned.
It's very close. It's the best of its kind that's been written. But he has made serious mistakes in it. But it's the best of its kind. Some of them that have criticised him can't do better.
I checked up on my copy of The Wild Colonial Boy and had a look at the foreword, which Clune calls a preliminary canter. I love that. And he says that the first two that he bought, Ben Hall the Bush, that he produced, Ben Hall the Bush Ranger and The Dark Outlaw, which I think would have been about Gardner, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think, yeah, his name is Darkie.
Darkie, yeah. He says straight away in the foreword of that he tended to heighten dramatic tension because it was historical fiction. But, as he said here, the present complete text published under the title of Wild Colonial Boys is authentic history throughout, as authentic as I could make it from the extensive material which was before me when writing it. Now, Clune spoke to people, which to me is a lot of folklore too.
Well, I think so. That's a great grab of Edgar Pensig.
Oh, isn't it?
I think, yeah, and Norrie too. But the two things have nicely juxtaposed there. I think Edgar was a kind of born-again reactionary after starting out as a convert, if you like, to bushranging. And when he, as he said, found out the facts, in other words, that they weren't, it wasn't all true, all the folklore wasn't historically true anyway, he kind of went the other way. But Morrie is obviously still keen on the folkloric idea that these guys were bush Robin Hoods. Regardless of how Clune had made mistakes about presenting them, and Clune's definitely on their side. There's no doubt about that. He's very sympathetic, I think, to the bush rangers that he talks about. So you've got the two things there nicely, not quite in balance, but
no. Edgar, I think, is probably a little bit more forceful than Morrie.
Yeah.
But there again, he had both sides of the fence, and that's fine. Now, Morrie himself, I just love that voice, and we're going to hear a little bit more of it. It's a real old Bushy's voice that was sort of strained through Roll Your Own Tobacco and Grog, I think. He was a lovely man and fascinating. Morrie was born in 1904, and when I went, it was one of the first interviews I ever did. And I went out and I spoke with him, and I just couldn't believe that he knew Dan Charters, who was one of the Ben Hall gang. Now, I think Dan was the one who turned evidence from memory.
Yeah, and they were very young too, that's the other thing. So it's quite certainly possible, I'm sure Morrie did, but it's certainly possible that he was around in time for Morrie to have a chat with Dan. He was known as Flash Dan, apparently, because he was pretty clean on the clothing and the gear, as a lot of them were, of course. And he also, as you say, filled the role of traitor, which again is another one of the characteristics of this outlaw hero tradition, of which our bushrangers are the Australian version.
Let's have a listen to a bit more of Morrie's voice and how he met Dan Charters, and my surprise.
And is any of the other people that you knew of in that time that had reminiscence? I know, as you said, it wasn't etiquette to ask them, but they
well,
they still...
It was only Charters, and that's where I got the full story to the plan and the escort robbery.
You knew Charters, did you say?
Yes, old Dan Charters.
Old Dan Charters.
And he wasn't anything like he's supposed to be. He was one of the finest men that I ever knew.
Where did you meet him, Murt?
Well, he went back to when I was a very small kid. Him and I don't know whether his wife died or whether she shot through on him. But when I first come across him, I was a very small kid. They had a home at... he was living on 40 acres of ground at Sandy Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to visit them. Old Dan come to Grenfell then to live. And the home broke up out there, possibly when his couple of his girls got married. And he come to live in Grenfell here. And then when I got to really see a lot of him was when Pinnacle Station was surveyed up in 1911. And, well, it was sold in 1911 and I suppose the surveyors started, but old Charters was sent out there and he was living in the overseer's cottage. He was caretaking the blocks to stop vandalism till the people come to get their blocks. Well, some of the blocks were never took till 1913. Damn. Well, he used to often come over to our place, and my father used to quiz him.
Yeah, so that's young Morrie talking about Dan Charters, Graham. Charters died in 1919, so it is all possible. It all falls into place.
Yeah, and again, still living locally, more or less in the area. So, yeah, certainly people would have known who they were. And as you said, people have long memories that outlive various people's lives as well. So they become personal memories, then become local and community folk memories.
Yeah. I gather that stories like that would change a bit too over the telling. I know that it's the same as telling a yarn, isn't it? If you tell the story so many times, that I know, even dare I say it, I tend to embellish things a bit as we go along.
It seems to be a human characteristic. Yeah. So, and they've got away, you know, the fisherman story of the one that gets bigger in every telling, the size of the fish. So it's exactly the same kind of process going on. And yeah, and that's really, I guess, much of the romance of it too. I think that's also attracted people like Clune and other writers and other people too, generally, who just find that it's a fascinating subject.
Let's have a listen to Morrie's story about probably the greatest robbery in Australian history, or for the time, a large amount of money. I forget, it was millions in today's dollars, I'd say. Let's have a listen to Morrie's memories from Dan Charters about the escort robbery, and it's a little bit different to what everyone else is sort of saying.
Briefly, you know, the eight men that carried out the robbery wasn't the eight men that planned it, according to Charters. There was five cattlemen that planned the thing, and none of them had any idea how to go about carrying it out. So they agreed to take Gardner and Gilbert in as equal partners, because they had the know-how. It was generally understood Ben Hall was the leader, but Gardner was his field officer, you know, to attend to detail. Well, as the time got close, four of the original five planners backed out. Ben Hall was actually the only man that was in the planning it that had the guts to go through with it. The other four, they jacked out and wanted to name somebody, wanted to nominate somebody to stand in for them. So Johnny Bow, Alec Fordyce, and Dan Charters, and Johnny O'Mealy was the four selected men. And so as they never know who they represented, Gardner was sent round to conscript them and promise them to play a praying concert for Frederick Pottinger. And they reached to get 50 quid for their share in it. Well, Bowen and O'Mealy, two boys in their teens, they jumped at it, reckoned they'd get some great fun out of it, apart from it as an easy 50 quid. Fordyce and Charters were two older men, and they tried to back away. But Gardner threatened them, and then they agreed to go in with it. They never knew what this joke and prank was to consist of. They only got an inkling at Jugowra when the rifles were, they were armed and equipped in Forbes, and on Sunday morning when their rifles were reloaded and recapped ready, that they got an inkling that the escort was the objective.
So there you go.
Very interesting. Yes, I mean, it does accord with, well, there's so many versions of the story. Who knows what happened exactly, or who did what when and with whom. But, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it, I think, as I understand it. There's was always been a bit of doubt about Ben Hall actually being there on the day. But in my reading of it, he probably was. It doesn't run a matter much anyway, because they were all involved in a criminal act, no doubt about it. But it was a great robbery. It was the 19th century Australian equivalent of the Great Train Robbery, really. They got away with an awful lot of money, and it kind of set a whole raft of things going in the area and beyond, which sort of took the next 3 years or so to sort out, with the police particularly, and even the authorities more generally being a bit concerned about the state of civil society in the Lachlan region.
Yeah, you did mention there the Bushranger Republic, Graham. What exactly is the direction of that?
Yeah, well, I'm gilding the lily a little bit there with that as well.
Good on you.
But the idea is here that you've got the Jugowra Rocks robbery, you've got characters like Gardner, Hall and Gilbert floating around. As well as that, there were two raids by the Bushrangers on Canoundra, one on Bathurst, which really freaked out the police and the authorities back in Sydney, the government. So it started to look a bit like things were moving on past just normal criminality towards things that might have been more dangerous for society, particularly as the Bushrangers had an awful lot of local support and sympathy, rightly or wrongly. So there was quite a lot of concern about that. So there's highly unlikely that they had any political intentions whatsoever, as Maurice says about everybody. The kids just thought they'd earn a quick 50 quid and have a bit of fun. Frank Gardner and Ben Hall were obviously older men who had a bit more maturity and realised what they were doing. But it was, and that's pretty much the level of it, I think. At the same time, you've got to look at it from the point of view of the authorities, who are thinking still about the fear of convict insurrections, which was a very big deal earlier on in the day. These people, Ben Hall was a son of convicts, I think, and others had convict connections, and that kind of thing was still in the popular mind at the time as well. So putting all that together, and you can understand why they were getting seriously concerned about what was going on there, and why they outlawed Hall, of course. Being outlawed is quite a big deal, in legally speaking, and it suggests that they were seriously concerned about the whole situation.
Yeah, well, there were the two raids on Canoundra, and a raid on Bathurst too, as well.
Yep.
Yeah. So there was this fear, if you wish.
There's no indication that the Hall and co had any kind of political intentions whatsoever, but as I said, because of what was going on there and the fact that the policing of this seemed to be getting out of hand. You had this enormous gold escort robbery. You've had all these people being held up. You've had raids on towns. There seemed to be bush rangers right, left and centre robbing everybody. And cops can't get them. So it's becoming, it becomes a problem, or perceived as a problem by the authorities back in Sydney.
Yeah. Of course, the death of Hall, we'll talk about that song, The Streets of Forbes, a little bit later, but there seems to be a lot of ballads, songs, myths and stories about Hall.
Oh yes, plenty of those. The the son with the marks on the skin, of course, was born with certain birthmarks, said to be the same number of birthmarks on the skin in Ben Hall's body.
Yeah, and that's something that I have come across, and I think in your written, in your research, you probably would have come across a lot of it written as well. I've come across a couple of newspaper articles where someone has mentioned it. Let's have a listen to Rod Butler, who I recorded at Woi Woi, would you believe? And of course, this again is bordering on the folklore thing, because he's talking about hairy moles, and in other places it's marks on the skin and various things, but it's always the same thing, that whatever this skin blemish is, it matches the number of bullet holes. Let's have a listen to Rod.
Rod, the last thing I wanted to talk to you was about your dad's reminiscences of Ben Hall.
Well, I don't even remember you telling me the full story as he knew it. I remember asking once about, you know, birthmarks, hairy moles, and he said that Ben Hall's son, I don't know who he was or anything, that he had a bullet, a hairy mole for every bullet mark. That, now, whether this was legend or, but he said on his face he had one the shape of a horse's head. And he said, I've seen them, and I've seen the marks on his body. Dad said, but I said, he said, whether they were where the bullets went in or what they were, or whether it went in or what the hell it was, I don't know. But he says that's the explanation they gave for them. And, of course, I think the story's pretty well known, where they, I think they shot him in his sleep. He, was it Kubung Mek that dobbed him in for the reward? Well, I think he'd done it. Kubung Mek some good turns. Still, I think he was married to one of his relatives or something. I forget the full story. But, Dad knew all about him.
Dad knew all about him. that's so common, I think, even in written or whatever, that they actually know about it.
Of course. I think we should just say an important detail in that story is that the son was born after Hall was killed, of course.
Yes.
It's a kind of slightly supernatural or potentially supernatural element to this particular legend as well.
Yes. So no matter what, no matter what the mark was, it just always matched this thing. And we had the extra bonus there with Rod of a mark on the head as well.
I haven't heard that one before.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, learn something every day.
You do. Sally Sloan, tell us about Sally Sloan, who you met, I believe, Graham.
Sally, I was lucky enough to meet Sally. I accompanied Warren Fay on a recording trip many, many, many years ago, and to record Sally, and she was a wonderful woman in every way. She was a great storyteller, a wonderful performer, of course, a musician and singer, and she also served up a pretty good cup of tea and cake, as I recall, too. That was very good. So we spent the day, or most of the day, up there with her. And I think that's Warren's recordings of that are in the National Library too. I'm not sure if they're available online, but she went mainly through the repertoire that had been recorded by John and others, of course, previously. But again, it's always great when folklorists can go back and talk to people who've been previously recorded, and often they come up with new things or different approaches, different renditions, and it all adds to the overall story, I think.
Sally was a carrier of some of the best Ben Hall songs and ballads, wasn't she, Graham?
Oh, yes, she's recognised as a great performer and a great tradition bearer, of course. And she's one of those rare rare people, I guess, in the oral tradition, if you like, who bring a whole lot of things together in one place, a whole lot of background. She had an Irish background, of course. She also had musical songs. She also had English songs. She also had bush ballads. She had the lot.
So let's have a listen to Sally talking about the leopard boy, as she called him, and the marks on his body. The interesting part about this is that it's not Hall's son she's talking about, but the son of Mrs. Goobang Mick. At the end of this, she gives us a lovely rendition of one of the Hall ballads as well, as only Sally can do it.
And poor Ben Hall, he had a property of his own near Forbes, and all the bad deeds that used to be done used to be pinned on to poor Ben Hall. And he was yarding his cattle this day, and they come on to him and took him into Forbes for a trial for something that he didn't do. And all his cattle was left in the yard. Instead of the police pulling the slip rails down and letting them out, they was all left to perish. And when he come out after doing a month in jail, they were just carcasses in the yard.
Didn't they burn his house down?
Yes, they burnt his place down, and his wife had betrayed him and went off with another man. He turned out to be a highwayman. He took on the bushranging. I saw the place where Ben Hall was killed. He lay down this day in ambush to
that, that was near Forbes?
Yeah, near Forbes, on the Lachlan Plain, to have a rest. And Goobang Mick always used to look after his money for him. And he lay there this day waiting for Goobang Mick to bring food to him. Instead of bringing food, he brought the cops. When the policemen come, they surrounded him and riddled his body with bullets. And Mrs. Goobang Mick knew that her husband used to look after the money for Ben Hall. And when she heard all these ear shots going into poor Ben Hall, she put her fingers to her ears and said, "Oh my God, poor Ben, that's Ben," she said, "my husband has betrayed him." And she was carrying a child at the time. And when the child was born, it had 32 white spots on it. And that child was exhibited through the length and breadth of Australia for show purposes. "Come all you young Australians and everyone beside, I'll sing to you a ditty that will fill you with surprise concerning all the but cruelly murdered was this day, which proved his downfall. An outcast from society was forced to take the road."
The hairs always stand up on the back of my neck when I hear that, Graham.
It's just what I was going to say, Rob. It's just a great bit of audio, and she does it so well, and it's such a great song. It's probably the best of all the Ben Hall ballads, in my personal opinion. The thing about the Ben Hall ballads is that most of them are tragics or tragedies, which is fairly unusual. Really, I mean, even with bushranger stories and songs, we tend to treat them for laughs in Australia. There's a few tragic Kelly ballads and a few sort of tragic other ones, but generally speaking, you know, they're sort of more or less send-ups and, you know, taking the piss. And most of the Ben Hall ballads, in fact, aren't that kind. They're that much more like the one that Sully just sang a part of there.
This is another one that John Meredith recorded from Gladys Scrivener, which is not in the same, or getting back to the class of what Sally was singing there, but it's still a good example of what was being sung.
Come all Australia's sons to me, a hero has been slain, and cowardly butchered in his sleep upon the Lachlan plains. Oh, do not stay, you seemly grief, but let a teardrop fall. All true manly hearts will ever mourn the fate of bold Ben Hall. No brand of Cain e'er stamped his brow, no widow's curse did fall. When times were bad, the Scottish dread the name of bold Ben Hall. He never robbed a needy chap, his record's best will show. He was staunch and loyal to his friends and manly to the foe. Oh, and savagely they murdered him, those cowardly bluecoat imps, who were set on to where he slept by informing peelers, pimps. For ever since the good old days of Turpin and Duval, the people's friends were outlaws who, and so was bold Ben Hall.
Yeah, the people's friends were outlaws too. So that's it's a classic
articulation
of the outlaw hero there, as of all the previous bits we've just been hearing, I think. So Ben Hall is a good bloke, but he's been done hard by money by the police and the government and various other things, which have turned him to outlawry. It's not his fault, it's someone else's fault. of course, they get celebrated in these songs in exactly that kind of way that comes through so strongly in those ballads.
Yes, and it's interesting too, being a local in the central west area, in the Forbes area, that I would say 80 to 90% of the people I have ever talked with in this area are Hall supporters. He was hard done by, so say nothing else.
That's right, good bloke, hard done by. That's it.
Now, I've heard on and off over the years that you could be arrested for treason if you sang any of those bushranger ballads, and I'll give you a story that John Meredith, who we've been talking about, who was wandering around with a tape recorder in the 1950s and later, of course, recording all these ballads, formed a band called the Bushwhackers, who were probably the first, if you want to call it, a bush band in Australia. And Meredith told me the story once that the Bushwhackers were performing for one of Dame Mary Gilmore's birthdays, her 80th or the 90th or something like that, and they sang a Hall ballad. And Doc Ebbett, now Doc Ebbett was the politician, wasn't he? He was...
And a barrister, yeah.
And a barrister, yeah. And Doc Ebbett came...
Eventually, yeah.
He came up to them and he said, you know, you can still be arrested for singing those songs. This was in the 1950s. And Meredith said to me, and Doc said to the Bushwhackers, but don't worry, I will defend you.
Yeah, now, that's great fun, isn't it?
I've never investigated that, whether the legality was there. I mean, it's quite possible, I suppose, that if you sang something like that, that you would end up in the slammer. But
I think Doc was probably either mouthing off the kind of the myth about this particular bit of legislation, or just had his tongue firmly parted in his cheek, which was also possible.
Oh, very possible.
Yeah, but look, no one's ever found any, as far as I know. I've looked, and I know other people have looked, but there isn't any. It doesn't make an awful lot of sense from a legal point of view. It'd be rather difficult to police, and probably it's a very strong belief, nevertheless, and you hear it all the time, but what it probably reflects is what we've been talking about in relation to this tradition of the outlaw hero, or the bushranger hero in our case, because once they get a bit out of hand, they are perceived as being a potential threat to authority. So it goes beyond the criminal into the potentially political. So, of course, the police are then involved, and then various kinds of repressive state apparatuses are brought to play to make sure that it doesn't get any worse.
Yes, so that again could be something that was a myth that was promoted by the police, perhaps, that don't sing those songs, otherwise you'll end up in jail. Yes.
That's right. It's quite possible that the local cops had run someone in, you know, or people in who were singing rebel songs in the bar at the local hotel with a bit more gusto than they should have been past closing time, you know, just and said, you know, on a more or less trumped up charge, really. So you can't sing them sort of songs here. We're running you in for the night. You know, those sort of things. But as far as a piece of legislation going, which sort of outlawed the singing of these particular songs, I'd really like to see it.
Yeah, another good story.
Yeah, oh, they're all good. They're all good.
Let's have a listen.
Not true, but they're all good.
Let's have a listen to Sally. I think she deserves just the end of that Ben Hall ballad. And obviously she didn't get arrested.
It's true, Australian sunny clime, Ben Hall will rain no more. His name is spread both near and far to every distant shore. From generations after this, parents will to their children call and rehearse to them the daring deeds committed by Ben Hall.
That's something, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Streets of Forbes, it's probably one of the greatest bushranger ballads we have.
Indeed it is, and one of the most problematic ones, I think, of all of them as well. It was collected by John Manifold from a lady in Bathurst, I think it was. Bathurst or Lithgow? I think Bathurst. Mrs. Ewell, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he recorded it in the back room of a Brisbane pub, according to Meredith, but she came from Bathurst, so
I thought there was a local connection somewhere. Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things about it. One is it's a fantastic song, and no doubt about that. Secondly, the tune is very unusual for an Australian bush ballad or, you know, traditional song in that kind of style, and sounds more like a kind of medieval or English modal tune of one kind or another. And no one else has ever collected it, as far as I know anyway, ever anywhere else. So we do harbour some dark thoughts about John in this particular case. But there's no doubt that it is a wonderful song. And I suspect what happened is that at some point John Manifold, who was a musician as well as a collector, got hold of John Maguire's poem about Ben's death. Maguire was his brother-in-law, and he wrote a poem which appeared in the Truth newspaper in 1911, and also there's an archive copy of it, I think, in the police records of the New South Wales Police that I found when I was researching this many, many years ago. And it's obviously the basis of The Streets of Forbes. It's changed a bit, but it's pretty much that story, and some of the lines are the same. So I suspect that John Manifold, a bit over-enthusiastic maybe, may have got hold of this and set it to a tune that he got from somewhere else and passed it off, really, as the real thing. He did have form in this respect. He had written a poem about Ned Kelly, which he once tried to pass off as being traditional, but got caught. So I think, you know, he was perhaps a bit over-optimistic. But nevertheless, it's a great song. And Marion does a great job of it.
She does indeed. So let's hear a little bit more of Marion.
Comrades, the outlaws did agree to give away bush ranging and cross the briny sea.
Thanks for listening to another Yarns of Oz podcast, written, produced and presented by Rob Willis, Graham Seal, and with archival grabs from the National Library Collection, including Pat Nicholson, Morris or Maury Stiles, Edgar Penzig, Rod Butler, Sally Sloan, and Gladys Scrivener. See you later.
He surrounded him as fast asleep he lay. Show the prize they had.